Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, the podcast that pushes the boundaries of the coaching profession with cutting-edge practitioners, authors, and thought leaders. Coaching Uncaged brings you pioneering thinking to enrich the art and science of coaching in all its forms. And now, introducing your host, Robert Stevenson.
So, welcome to the podcast. Today, I will be talking with Fatoumata Jatta, a clinical psychologist, a transformational coach, but also a researcher, a trainer working in difference and diversity, as well as lots of other things. It's great to have you on the call with us today, and I'm really excited about sort of where this conversation will go to.
Yeah, thank you, Robert. Thank you. Same here. Really excited to be talking with you, just talking with the Animas community in general. Just happy to explore this and see where this goes. Thank you for having me.
So the original thought behind this particular podcast was sort of bringing in that the psychologist in you into the space around what's happening in the coaching space as we sit with a pandemic and what might be happening for coaches in that. But before we sort of dive into that, I think it'd be great if we could maybe get a snapshot of your history today leading to being a psychologist and also a transformational coach.
Yeah, sure. So I guess it started with, you know, my degree. It was in law. I did law with French law. Then sort of wasn't really sure what I wanted to do myself. Took a while to figure that out. And in the meantime, I was working in property. So doing sort of like legal conveyancing, property management, that kind of thing. And then moved over into psychology. Actually, I moved over into coaching first. So I did my training at Animas first, and then I did my clinical psychology doctorate. And that's kind of led off into a bunch of things. So I did my thesis on cultural competency and female genital mutilation. So because of that, I do difference and diversity training. So I was saying earlier, that's been quite interesting working, not just with sort of, psychology students, like the next clinical psychologists, but also companies and helping them kind of make sense of the Black Lives Matters movement and having these like open conversations now around difference and diversity and what it means. And I do training on female genital mutilation with professionals. And continue sort of research and training in general. But my main line of work at the moment is sort of clinical psychology work with individuals, couples, and families.
So there's a real mixture of the work that you do there, and I'm always interested to sort of notice how those different careers or those different pathways, how they sort of sit together with the sort of the current work that you're doing.
Yeah, I think it's I guess because it's happened quite organically. I'm someone who just finds lots of different things interesting, and then maybe have thought, you know, I sort of need to focus in some way as well. That's also been important. But I think I just kind of think of it as not putting myself in any box, you know, having like a main line of work that I'm pursuing, but also having these other interests. And if opportunities come up, I take them or I sort of seek them out. But, you know, really kind of following the things that I'm passionate about. So clinical psychology, that's sort of like helping people with mental health, coaching, helping people lead the best lives that they can, you know, whatever their situation is. And then sort of, you know, difference and diversity culture, what it means to assimilate, what it means for groups of people to kind of work together, you know, as a whole. And then, of course, female genital mutilation is something that's kind of I'm personally affected and impacted by and have used kind of my personal experience as well as what I've learned, through my studies to sort of and professional life to sort of train and kind of, you know, pass the message forward. That's sort of my approach.
There are so many strands in there that we could sort of pull on. I think it might be useful just to to maybe start with the what's happening now space. And
yeah.
I guess there's two things in that. There's the Black Lives Matter element, but there's also the sort of the impact of a pandemic in the space element. And I remember when we first started having this conversation, and I was sort of saying to you as a coach, what were you noticing in this space? But also, you know, as a doctor, what were you noticing in this space? And perhaps what you were noticing with other coaches or professionals, how they were being impacted on this.
Yeah, so I guess with the work, I think it felt like a very distinct kind of impact when it all started. It was very unusual, very uncertain, you know, brought up lots of anxieties. People were suddenly, their usual routines and ways of, you know, coping and handling things had been sort of taken away and removed. So there was, it felt like a particular kind of a situation. And that really came up in the coaching and the psychology space, just kind of discussing what this specific impact, you know, the specific impact was and the anxieties it brought up. Since then, it's felt like more of a background thing. So because it's ongoing now, there's less of that, oh God, this is, you know, what do we do with this? What does this mean? It's more people are sort of, I feel that a lot of people are kind of seeing that, you know, this has been a change for everybody. And that's a particular, you know, that means something in itself. And then it's sort of like going back to the things that they're struggling with individually, apart from that, but that being in the background as something maybe like sometimes a barrier to, you know, getting them to where they want to be, but also sometimes like a positive thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So you have maybe social anxiety clients struggle with socially. They're having less triggers right now because they're at home. There are less situations where they're out socially. So actually, in some cases, it's been a question of like, this has been a place to sort of reflect and have some time apart and be able to kind of work on some things in a different way. And then I do peer-to-peer supervision with another coach. And that's certainly something that, you know, we've talked about the impact on us and how it's kind of played out coaching, but also in our private lives. I think you just can't really have those conversations without saying what is going on and it's ongoing as well. And just an important factor.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because you talked about it as being background, and I often wonder sometimes when things fall into the background for us, they have an impact on us without us recognizing it, because we're kind of almost not ignoring it, but we're just accepting it as is and not recognizing the challenges or the bias that it creates for us in the space. And I'm always interested in, you know, what's happening for us as coaches that we're not aware is happening, and how might we address that? And I guess that's part of my pull around this conversation, is, you know, what might be that stuff that's happening underneath that we might need to take a look at and bring to the surface, kind of go, oh, that's impacting the space.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. One of the main things I've noticed, not just in myself, but pretty much anyone I've spoken to, you know, including clients, is people often sort of almost like, you know, they'll talk about whatever they're struggling with, and then there's a caveat. But, you know, we're all going through this, but it's, you know, it could be a lot worse. But, you know, I have it very, very good compared to, you know, someone who's maybe losing relatives or is very unwell or, you know, is losing jobs or it just sort of there's that caveat, which I think as a psychologist and coach, you notice, because that's someone sort of putting their needs and their experience somewhere in the background. Mm. Saying, you know, actually in context, you know, it could be a lot worse. And that's true. But it's also important to have the space to process what we are going through individually. That's just as important.
Yeah, and as you say that, it makes me wonder about how many of us as coaches or as therapists or you know, as practitioners are actually taking the time to go, well, what's happening for me? What do I need to process as well as my clients processing this? You know, am I also saying but in this and need to maybe be saying and or just sitting with it a little bit more? It's just, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not sure how everyone else is handling it, but I have my own coaching and I also have my own therapy. And I think they're both really, really important, you know, whether it was one or the other, but having that space for myself where there's another professional who's kind of, I guess, you know, noticing my blocks and my defenses, or noticing, you know, where I minimize my own experience, and helping me with that. Because I think it is super easy to do, you know, the profession that we've got is very much about thinking about other people's needs and helping them with those, being the one that's relied on or the strong one. There's lots of beliefs around what we do. And not just that, but all lots of reasons why we end up being attracted to, you know, doing the job that we do. There's probably, you know, something if you take it back to our early days where, you know, in some ways we're maybe used to having had to do that. I know in my case, there is a bit of that story. So, yeah, I think it's very important to be aware of, because otherwise you sort of, we have our own blind spots. We're human.
Yeah, I like that phrase you said there, that sort of minimizing our own experience. And that, I think that's really interesting how we can notice that within our clients and we can notice that within our peers to kind of go, are we minimizing here? Are we almost, what's that phrase I'm looking for? I can't quite remember it right now, but I know there's a transactional analysis phrase where we talk about somebody doing that and it's almost, discounting. There you go. It came to me in the end.
Yeah.
Are we discounting our own experience? Are we discounting our own wants and needs and putting them aside for those of others? And as you were saying, that coaches and therapists, practitioners, we come to this work sometimes through a healing a need of our own or wanting to create an experience that we have gone through ourselves, perhaps through therapy and coaching, and recognizing the impact that it's had on us, going, well, how can I help somebody else go through that? But also kind of, I think what you were hinting towards there, or maybe what I was just taking from it, that, you know, what's been our role in our own groups, our own societies, our own families, that then might lead us to being the coach. And you kind of hinted towards that for yourself, and I was curious as to what a bit of that backstory was.
Yeah, sure. I guess you know, I think, yeah, there's lots to the backstory, I suppose. But maybe for me, like a really obvious one is just being the eldest. So I'm the eldest of six children. And, you know, I'm from the Gambia. It's a sort of African country. Traditionally, you know, there's a hierarchy of sort of, you know, age. There it's sort of less of, you know, in the Western world, it's very much the older you get, maybe the less you feel like you're important in some ways. In Gambia, it's been the opposite, which is, you know, the older you get, the more respect you have, the more responsibility you have, etc. And so just growing up with that, really, you know, just look after your, you know, your younger siblings. We also went to a boarding school in the UK, away from our family. So I was here kind of, you know, aged maybe, wonder how old was I when we started? So 13, 14, with sort of younger siblings who were like sort of, you know, 10, 7. And, you know, you take, rightly or wrongly, you know, whether it's explicit or implicit, it's that kind of, at least I felt very responsible for my siblings. And I think just, you know, having parents who went through a difficult divorce and sort of, you know, being there for my mother, again, rightly or wrongly, just that kind of child mind of feeling responsible for others. I think, yeah, for me, that's I can kind of make direct links to how I feel sometimes in the coaching space or the therapy space to maybe how I might have felt as a child back then.
That's really interesting. As you talk about that, I kind of hear my own parallels existing in there, being the eldest, and having that responsibility of looking after your siblings through, you know, family circumstance, and kind of going, that's interesting. I wonder how that's played out throughout my life or throughout my coaching practice. And how much of that stuff we're not aware of that kind of sneaks in, which reminds me again of that, the background of pandemic and that sneaking into our now and us not kind of noticing it.
Yeah, I guess the word that came up to mind that sort of, you know, ticked something there for me was awareness, you know, being aware, because I think awareness is really important, because it's sort of sometimes in the coaching space or the therapy space, it's sort of like, what's this person bringing versus what am I bringing with, you know, my day, but also my past and my history. And, you know, is this for my client or is this about me? But also kind of my choices, you know, am I doing this because I want to or because I feel I must? And if I, if for example, I don't, you know, get the change that I thought I might get or want, do I then blame myself? Do I internalize it? You know, does it take me back to times when I wanted to be responsible and take care of siblings or parents and what wasn't able to? And now I'm kind of, you know, experiencing some of that here. It's just that awareness of things that are, you know, what's going on. And then from the awareness, having choice, right? Because I might be aware that this is a link and I might still choose it because this is what feels, you know, this is what I want. This is why I feel passionate about this. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just the awareness.
I always find these conversations fascinating, the directions and the shifts and change that happen as we're having them. And, you know, I know I sort of started off with this idea of exploring the impact of coaches through a pandemic. But there's something here as well that's sort of surfacing for me. And that's around this idea of having trained both as a coach and as a psychologist, and how that helps you, or not necessarily helps, but how that enables you to look at your work perhaps in a different way than a coach that hasn't had that extra training or that additional training. Because as you're talking there, I can really hear you kind of unpicking, recognizing, seeing, making the choices, and they kind of go, that's really interesting that you're able to do that, almost to self supervise in a way.
Yeah, I guess maybe self-supervise, but I would say that's coming from lots of, you know, external supervision too. I think that's super important. So like the peer-to-peer supervision I've got, and also I have my own supervisor for therapy, because we have to, for our registration, my own therapist. So lots of, you know, ways that I have, you know, help to do that, because I think it's quite difficult sometimes to just look at yourself internally, especially if you're triggered. You know, for example, one of the things might be, I was thinking about, you know, why we might minimize our own experience. You know, there's lots of different reasons why we might do that. And some might be, you know, wanting to help others and that being really important to us. Sometimes it might be, you know, struggling with our own anxieties, being uncomfortable with it. And so sometimes it's maybe easier focusing on, you know, helping or even fixing something outside of ourselves. And, you know, I wonder sometimes, you know, I think that's an important question for coaches and therapists to have, you know, what may I be avoiding in this space for myself? You know, do I want to keep doing that?
Yeah, that's made me think about that, the idea of, as we go through this time, that there will be coaches that are struggling to find clients or to hold on to clients as the sort of the economic impact kind of kicks in around this. And it it would be interesting. It'd be interesting to look at, are we as coaches looking at that? Are we recognizing that our livelihoods are being challenged here? Are we putting our heads in the sand around this and going, I don't want to look up and see what's happening in the landscape because I might see that coming towards me? I don't really have a question, just a reflection that's coming to mind.
Yeah, and I guess it's just that question, right? It may be a yes to that or a no, depending on someone's circumstances of where they're at. But it's just maybe, you know, it's the questions, right? That's what we're good at, I guess, asking the questions that may bring some sort of a level of new awareness for somebody. But yeah, I think it's definitely valid, especially right now when there is so much going on and so much that's potentially anxiety provoking. At the same time, I've also heard of the fact that, you know, people have maybe been furloughed, for example, and had the time then to focus on their coaching practice. So, for example, I actually started my business. I was working before sort of online, here and there while I was training. So I had a trickle of clients, but really sort of focusing and making it my main line of work. That started just as lockdown started. And I think it was partly the fact that I wasn't going out, didn't have that lot of distractions. I was able to sort of sit and focus on that. So it's kind of, I think it can be very anxiety provoking. At the same time, there's also been lots of opportunities within it that are important to kind of be aware of.
Yeah. I agree that this is it's a challenging time, but in those challenges, there are opportunities. And how can we see the opportunities within that challenge? And sometimes it can be very hard to notice them because of the nature of the challenge or the extent that one might be feeling that challenge or the anxieties that are triggered through that. One of the other thoughts that was coming to mind for me was I very much felt that the sort of the resurgence of Black Lives Matter, yes, there was the George Floyd incident, which really brought things into frame. But it also felt like because we were in a pandemic, there was almost a pressure cooker effect around it that really forced reactions to it. I felt that we weren't able to be distracted by other things because those things didn't exist. And therefore, we had to really face what was going on, a little bit like what you were saying around furlough, giving us the time to reflect and perhaps take opportunity, but also just to look at who we are. I'm just curious about your thoughts around sort of the resurgence of Black Lives Matter through the sort of pandemic space.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was, it's sort of that thing like where there's a mixture of ingredients, right? A perfect storm. Mm. What I noticed in sessions with clients was, the pandemic itself was a very difficult, challenging experience in one way, particularly with people who have, mental health difficulties or life isn't where they want it to be. And then add on top of that, all the news that we're getting regularly, the fact that it was impacting or seemed to be impacting minority people at much higher rates. So in the UK, I think if you were Black, or BAME, you were sort of four times more likely to have serious complications from COVID. So I was, it was sort of that plus, and there are people still being, killed, murdered in this way. And sort of, all those images and all that coming together, I think it was just sort of people saying, yeah, no, this is not okay. We can't turn away from this. And it was the mixture, right? Because there was the George Floyd murder, and then there was the lady in the park who saw a Black man and he sort of said, your dog can't be here. And she sort of immediately went into, I'm going to call the police and I'm going to tell them that you're threatening my life, something like that. And it was caught on camera. And it was very obvious at that point that there are some people that are complicit in this institutional racism. They're not just, turning a blind eye, but they're also using it to their advantage. And I think it was like the combination of all of these things together that people were sort of like, no, we can't, you know, we can't say, we can't just pretend this isn't happening anymore. It is happening.
And I was just thinking about the sort of the organizational work you do around difference and diversity. How does sort of race and culture and Black Lives Matter, how does that show up within that work?
Yeah, so the organizational work I do specifically is to go into, you know, companies and help them understand that. So help them have these conversations that are really, really difficult. They are awkward, which is kind of, you know, why people then tend to avoid having them, or, you know, find all sorts of ways to get around it. And it's, you know, literally starting out with, you know, okay, this is why we're here. But also this is what gets in the way of having these conversations. Mm. You know, it might be that you feel, you know, you feel guilty. Maybe there's white guilt here. Maybe, you know, you feel like, and these are things that are, you know, I'm Black, right? So these are some things that I hadn't actually realized myself. So even, you know, when I started doing research and sort of looking and preparing the workshops, the sort of people would sometimes say things like, you know, I don't speak up, I don't say anything for fear of, you know, I might say the wrong thing, or for fear of, you know, who am I, how dare I speak up? Whereas, you know, I was maybe experiencing it as, you know, I'm not speaking up because I have the luxury to not speak up. It doesn't matter enough to me. I can get away with not speaking up. And they're very different points of view, right?
Yeah.
And once you sort of open that up for everybody and sort of allow people to say what their experience is, even sort of, you know, white men saying, I'm feeling really like attacked right now, you know, even for just being me. And, you know, that's not the aim of, you know, having a company that sort of is comfortable with difference and diversity. But yeah, I see the job as facilitating uncomfortable discussions that then create empathy, you know, create understanding, and in that, you know, a short shared common goal for a company.
Yeah, it really resonates with me around this idea that they're difficult conversations sometimes to have, but also the idea that sometimes people go, I'm not having the conversation because I don't know how to, and I don't want to get it wrong. And how even with some of the work that I've been looking at within Animus about, you know, inclusion and diversity, equality, that space, and going, so what do we do? I've also hesitated at times going, is there a right to this? Is there a phrasing that we should be using in inverted commas? You know, how do we go about this? And finding my own self stuttered in the work for, I guess, fear of getting it wrong or fear of offending when we're really working on bringing in and including, but at the same time worrying about, you know, what's the language that we might use that might trigger shame, embarrassment, defense into the space when actually that's not what we're trying to do. And I guess dialogue and coaching gives us a language or perhaps an intention that allows us to push through that and to have the discussions that allow things to surface and evolve.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, just awareness, right? Because I guess the danger is when we make assumptions. So, you know, it's sort of like, you know, it's interesting, you know, just so many different fears that come up, or anxieties. So a common one for company leaders or sort of CEOs and managers is, you know, by pointing this out, am I kind of making minority people feel different? Am I singling them out? You know, shouldn't I just be treating them like they're all the same and not see difference? It's a really common one, a little bit like the All Lives Matter sort of reaction to Black Lives Matter. And again, it's you know, that's a it's very, you know, natural. I could understand why, you know, that would be a response. It makes sense. But actually, when we do that, we are taken away from people's experience. We're sort of saying there's no space here for actually the difference that you have felt or the kind of, you know, your particular challenges. Mm. It's more about allowing a space for people to be able to kind of talk about those. I think it's interesting linking it to the pandemic and COVID, because that's also involved things like, you know, less job security. Mm. You know, people worried about, you know, can they kind of progress up in a company? You know, can they move across? And of course, when we worry about job security, we're maybe less able to be empathetic. You know, when fear is there, we're less able to kind of think about others. And so, you know, it's been a particular, I think that's been interesting as well, kind of holding those that in mind when doing this work.
That's interesting. I hadn't really thought about how the fear of job security can also create a siloing or a locking down of one's position, because you're worried about, am I going to have a job next week? I'm not going to rock the boat. I'm not going to challenge what's happening in the space because jobs are going and I don't want mine to go. So I'm going to almost, you know, stay part of the furniture than challenge what's taking place. That's really interesting about how, you know, how our fears sort of show up and materialize in different ways.
Yeah, and there might be different ones that, you know, depending on, you know, our experiences. So, you know, very crude distinctions, but, you know, a white man might sort of say, am I going to lose my job to a minority person? Because, you know, I'm sort of, you know, I'm thought of now as privileged. And actually, you know, I'm worried about, you know, job security. A minority person might sort of say, you know, am I going to rock the boat? You know, am I going to be that annoying person that's kind of, you know, complaining again or causing problems or whatever it might be? I just want to sort of be really nice and really friendly and just, you know, work extra hard. And that's how I've been taught, you know, to manage in this world, you know, be that kind of like, you know, that really helpful, you know, friend or whatever it might be, or employee. Mm. You know, it's just, yeah, there might be all these different things going on, different ways that we have figured out to cope with what's difficult, what's uncomfortable, but may not be in the long term the most effective way of managing conflict or difficulty.
And I guess that just by having these conversations and creating a space where the conversations can be had, allow these things to come into the space and allow us to begin to having the long-term conversation, even if we are in the middle of a pandemic, which is causing us to have that short-sighted thought process, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. And that I guess it's a continued conversation. You know, it's sort of like, because you have the conversation once doesn't mean that it's all, you know, hunky-dory and it's great. It's more that actually it's facilitating the ability to maybe for people to have these conversations regularly, or just have a space where it's allowed to sort of say, look, we, I don't feel like there are enough female, you know, managers or females, you know, in positions that I can look up to. Or that I've, you know, if I feel that there's a problem, you know, that I can talk to people that, you know, maybe understand or connect with me on that level, you know, that just opens up that regular sort of, regular maintenance, because that's what it takes.
Yeah, this is, you know, one of those fascinating conversations as we sort of dance around different themes and ideas, and as we explore them, I guess all linked to some extent what's happening right now in terms of the pandemic and how we are responding to that, but also how it creates gateways for other things to be responded to, because I think it really has pressure cookered the, if that's a phrase, the sort of Black Lives Matter into the space. And it's also, I think, created a sustained conversation with that. Whereas, you know, as you say, sometimes we feel that we've had the conversation, therefore it's done. I feel this has been a time but that we're continuing to have the conversation, and organizations like ours are bringing that idea into their philosophy or into their missions to kind of continue that work as an ongoing process, as opposed to a, well, let's run a workshop and we've done the work. It's more like, well, what else can we do? And let's keep doing that work.
Yeah, absolutely. And interestingly, one of the things that comes up in the research is that there's a thing like diversity fatigue is a thing. And that means, you know, companies reaching a limit where they feel like, you know, they've talked about this enough and done, you know, enough work, and, you know, what else can they do? Mm. And, you know, they just reach a sort of fatigue around it. And again, because it's uncomfortable. And, you know, when things are uncomfortable, we have natural defenses and responses to them, you know, main one being avoidance. And actually, you know, we, in a way, it's a proactive effort to counter that. It's not really passive. It's quite an active, it's an active process.
Yeah, yeah. That makes a lot of sense around that fatigue, because we can feel that, whether it's about, you know, race and culture or gender. I've noticed in the past with other organizations I've worked with, where you get to a point where you do sometimes feel like, you know, haven't we done this enough? We've been here before, and let's park that now and move on to something new, as opposed to recognizing that part of the feeling that you've been here before is because you haven't unpicked it enough. You haven't done enough of the work for it to be okay, or to recognize that we need to keep coming back here and we need to keep checking in. A little bit like I was having a conversation the other day with Claire Norman about coaching competencies, and this idea of working with mentor coaches, not just when you need to get your next credential, but perhaps periodically as part of an MOT, just coming back in and checking in. Are we still doing this? Okay, are we still doing this right? What else might we need to do within this space?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I guess with that, it's just, you know, opportunity and possibilities and creativity, you know, just asking those questions. That's really important. And I guess I was thinking also about sort of this fatigue idea being quite relevant to our profession, you know, as coaches and therapists, because of the idea of burnout. Mm. You know, if we're not mindful of why we do things and the impact on us, if we're not reflective, that's the danger, right? That we get to a point where we burn out, and it can happen where, you know, we just can't take anymore. And so, yeah, it's a really important part of it. Knowing, you know, when to self-care, knowing when it's time for us to unload, knowing, when to stop working, all of that.
That really strikes a chord with me, especially now, because I think a lot of coaches felt like they had to do something. Mm.
Yeah.
And they had to do work for free, and they had to help everybody else, because being a coach, you are the supporter. And I wonder how many will come out the other side of this in that fatigued space, going, do you know what, I'm done with this. And they're not actually stepping back and taking care of themselves, or recognizing that they don't have to meet everybody's needs all of the time just because they're a coach or a therapist.
Yeah. And I'm just finding sort of creative ways of managing that, you know. So if you're someone who struggles with saying no, so I personally probably struggled with saying no to opportunities, or saying no to sort of let's say, you know, clients or whatever, just feeling like, you know, if someone asks, if I've started that relationship, then I feel a sense of responsibility. Mm. That I must kind of, you know, do something with this, and giving myself permission to sort of say, okay, maybe I can just, you know, close requests, or have a standard response that I give, you know, something that's kind of given myself permission to be able to do that, because I know that internally I struggle with that, and I have kind of worked through all sorts of feelings like guilt and And yeah, main one being guilt.
I always find it refreshing when we're able as coaches to recognize our own humanness within this work. Because sometimes we get so kind of caught up in what we do, we forget that we are human too. And we have all of those struggles as well. And then it's okay to have those struggles and those challenges and to have to work through stuff ourselves.
Yeah, I think it's also like a really powerful tool to what we have. Which is that of normalization, you know, normalizing the human experience. You know, a lot of the time when people are coming, they're struggling with something that's very, very normal, very universal, but they're feeling, you know, like they shouldn't feel that way. That if they were only better or doing this, they wouldn't feel like this. And actually, it's one of the important things that we have, which is to say, you know what, you know, I've also experienced that, or lots of other people experience that. And just because I am a coach or I'm wearing this hat or this a therapist doesn't mean that I'm immune to that. If anything, maybe more aware. Yeah, I think that's interesting because there are different, particularly even in psychological models or stances, where and I think it's a personal thing. So there are some therapist coaches that are very comfortable with self-disclosure and using it as a tool, and others that are not, you know, they want to kind of have that barrier. And I sometimes will, you know, ask the question, who is that protecting? You know, is it protecting your client or is it actually protecting you? And do you want to keep that wall up?
Yeah, we often have conversations around that, you know, how much do I disclose about myself as a coach and how much of that is useful and how much of that is in some way just glorifying the self as opposed to being an instrument of work or a tool within in the work that we do, whilst at the same time going that people come to me because of who I am and the resonance that they have with me. So there's always that balance around how much we share and how much we don't share.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we might not always get it right. I don't think I always do. Sometimes I'm like, oh, you know, if I had more time, or if I'd given myself a bit more time to sort of step back and reflect, would I have said that? Maybe not. And that's also okay, right? Because, you know, we can't be perfect, but it's more about this idea of being reflective and being really aware that, you know, there are these various possibilities available to us. There's no necessarily right or wrong.
Totally, yeah.
What's your approach out of curiosity?
It's a bit of both. I'm always really mindful about how sharing my stuff or my story might be collusive with what's going on for my my coachee or my client. So sometimes I will share and say, okay, I can recognize, or this is an experience that I have had, to then go, what can you draw from me sharing that, or what comes to mind for you? I remember when I first started coaching, or I was first trained, they were very much like, you don't share anything about yourself. So whenever the clients were trying to find out who I am, I was very distant. But what I find that does is make you somebody else. You're not then in the space with the client. So one of the other things I try to do is share who I am through, whether that's articles or blogs or social media, so people can actually see me as the human being out there. So they know that stuff about me to an extent. You know, we don't put all of our life out there, so that when they are with me in the space, they have a sense of knowing who I am. So I think there's I try to balance it, but I'm always, well, not always, but often checking in of why am I sharing this? Am I sharing this to validate something in myself, or because I think this is useful for the person I'm working with? And I'm more up for sharing a bit of who I am. Yeah.
Makes sense. I think I was just thinking, just particularly because, you know, especially in therapy, no matter what model you're using, and I think it's the same in the coaching space, the the biggest determinant of, you know, a client maybe getting what they want out of the work is the therapeutic relationship, the relationship that you build.
Yeah.
And so, you know, part of that means you being a human in that relationship.
Absolutely.
And I guess that's the stance I take, you know, that it's a tool in the development of that relationship. But I'm very kind of aware that this is a relationship for them, and that's why I'm here. But using that, you know, as in whatever way feels kind of helpful.
Because it's when that the relationship becomes edges into friendship, and it's like, this is work. Yeah. This is not friendship. So what I'm bringing here is to help with the work, as opposed to building a friendship bond. But absolutely, the quality of the relationship, you know, in all the stuff that I've looked at that talks about coaching relationships or therapeutic relationships, says that, you know, the quality of that is important. And I can know that when you have that really great quality, then you can push, you can go further with the client. And also the client is more willing to open up and to share when they feel that this is a rock solid supportive relationship that's equal and collaborative, a partnership, as opposed to a distant connection kind of thing.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you said earlier as part of your work, as you were describing at the beginning, the sort of the different things that you do, you talked about the work in female genitalia
mutilation. Yeah.
And I was just kind of rang a bell of kind of curiosity, partly about how does that work sit in with your coaching and the sort of at the therapeutic space in which you work, and whether you were working sort of organizationally with this or with this a community piece. That's more sort of me being curious about how you work and what you do.
It's had different guises. It's grown. I think when I started out, it was just I did like a self-development course, and part of that was doing a community project that, you know, was giving back, but also, you know, giving to yourself. And I had a lot of shame around the fact that I have experienced female genital mutilation, lots of stuff around, you know, feeling like less of a woman, and you know, quite angry about sort of the loss and, you know, lots of things that I had to process. And of course, one of the big antidotes to shame is disclosure, because once you disclose something and you have people accept it, then, you know, there's no reason to feel shame anymore. Of course, it's like a, you know, it's just because you do it once doesn't mean it's gone, but it's a cumulative effect. And so there was something in it for me of going public, let's say. But also I felt that it was really important to kind of bring awareness to this issue that affects, you know, a lot of African women, millions and millions and millions. And so it started out that way. That led into working for a charity, training professionals on FGM and how they might see it in girls, what they might do with it, how to discuss it, what the legal implications were, etc. And then throughout my doctorate, my training, I did sort of training here and there, and then I did my thesis on it as well. So I was just looking at reporting around FGM and how clinicians kind of handle it and manage it. It being something that in some cultures is okay and is acceptable, and parents do it because they think it's good for their children and their families. And then, you know, in this country, it's illegal. So as a clinician, that's a particular type of work, you know, because it's not someone abusing their child because they think it's, you know, bad, but it's what they're doing, even in with good intentions, can be abusive. Yeah. And so how do you manage that as a clinician? And that's kind of the question that I've looked at and just done research around that, really, but continue to sort of speak up about it. And because it's public, it means that, you know, if maybe clients look me up it's something that will come up. Sometimes I wonder about that. And still that sort of, ooh, what does that, you know, are people going to judge me? What will they think of me comes up? But at the same time, it hasn't come up. And I hope it just allows people to kind of maybe see me as a real person who shares some vulnerabilities that maybe allowed them to kind of see their own vulnerabilities and that they don't have to hold shame for them. In the same way that when I was looking for information on FGM, women who had spoken up about it beforehand helped me, you know, immensely. I realized I'm not alone and there's people out here talking about this.
Thank you for being so open in the discussion around this. I really appreciate that and thank you for that. And really recognize that when we talk about it, it creates a space for others to also have that discussion. And even if they don't have the discussion, to have that self-recognition of it, people are talking about it and there is support out there for it. And we can explore it and not have to feel shame and hide away, as it were.
Yeah. I think that's, FGM is one example, but mental health in general, or just, you know, people struggling or having failed businesses and having to kind of build themselves up, you know, all of those stories that allow us to connect with other people, but also gain something, you know, from realizing that, you know, challenging times are just part of life. And, it doesn't mean that, you know, we don't have to hold on to negative beliefs about them. I think it's just really, really powerful. You can see examples all over. I think I always say whenever you watch a TED talk, they start with a story, you know, about themselves, something that you can connect with, because, you know, that's what we kind of need, really.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I've been rereading some of my work that I did with David Drake recently, and that whole idea about, you know, what are the stories that people share about themselves in the coaching space telling us? What are the clues that they're giving out in that space, and how as coaches might we listen to and hear those clues? But also in a more generalistic idea, how our stories are who we are, and we share those stories of who we are for others to hear and understand us. And also our brains are kind of drawn into story. We want to hear the stories. There's almost like a comfort in being told a story and sharing our stories.
Yeah, I mean, we're, you know, meaning making machines, aren't we? So we'll find a story no matter what. And so it's about, does the story, you know, serve us or not? And of course, a lot of what we're doing, right, is kind of reframing, helping people reframe stories to something that's much more helpful for them. And, you know, your background in drama is a huge tool for that, right? And you know, I use role play a lot in work, and I try to have fun with that, you know, and just play. And I think, yeah, it's really, really important part of what we do, including, you know, the story about the pandemic or, all of that.
Yeah. A piece of work that a friend of mine is doing, he's collecting the stories of the community, especially the young around in the community, their stories of what does it mean to go through a pandemic? How has it impacted them, especially working with sort of minorities in Eastern North London, kind of going, you know, as young people, what are your stories here? What's the challenges that this has created for you? And let's share your story so we can learn from each other's stories and also recognize that our stories have themes that are the same that run through them, and in those themes we can recognize each other.
I'm so curious about, you know, the pandemic in 10 years time or whatever, and how we're going to look back on it and how the story is going to go. And you know, our generation, I don't know whether that there'll be people listening who maybe work with young people who, you know, maybe this is the time in their life when they should have been, you know, having parties for the first time, or, you know, kissing people for the first time, or, you know, all of that stuff that they are, you know, have had about a year off from that. And that, I think, I'm really curious about the impact on that, on the generation.
I feel like we could talk forever because it just triggered in my mind that whole idea of rites of passage and how we've missed moments of those rites of passage. You know, graduations have been missed, and what does that mean? And that those start-stop moments that we have that haven't happened, can we go back and have them again? Does it have the same meaning? I also feel like we should make a date in the diary to come back together in 10 years' time and go, you know, what has that story been, and how has that sort of played out over time?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, really interesting. I thought about it with people with children as well, you know. I think it was really difficult homeschooling, of course. And at the same time, there were suddenly children who have their parents around all the time, you know, and what that must have been like for families where, you know, they could make use of that, you know, that really kind of connected family time that maybe, you know, we wouldn't normally have under, you know, under other circumstances. I'm sure there's a whole bunch of different experiences out there around it.
I think it'd be lovely for people to share those experiences with us, those both the challenges that they've faced, but also what's this created for you? What's the opportunities or the new experiences that you wouldn't have had that have come from this period of time?
Absolutely.
It's been an absolute pleasure having this conversation with you today. I feel like we could talk about everything and anything forever. So thank you so much for joining with me today.
Oh, it was really, really interesting. I loved it. I think, two curious people just being curious, right? I really enjoyed it. Thank you for that.
And if people want to get hold of you, if they want to sort of read any of your research or work with you, where might they find you?
Yeah, so I mean, just looking up Dr. Fatoumata Jatta. I have an Instagram page, which is Dr. Jatta _psychologist. Also a page on Psychology Today, which is probably the best way to contact me, as well as email, which is drjatta@gmail.com. Very welcome to get in touch. I'm always open to making new connections.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Robert.
Take care.
If you'd like to watch these episodes as well as listen, you can find the video interviews on our YouTube channel and website now. Thanks for tuning in to Coaching Uncaged. Join us again for more captivating conversations, exploring the art of coaching.